your capital, right, when you're young is your time. And so you should really be thinking about how do I spend that time working with the best possible people that I will learn the most from and putting myself in the, if anything, the situation that will stretch my comfort zone the most and will help me grow the most. When I started Better World Books, I was a complete idiot about most things. Honestly, I thought I knew way more than I actually knew. You know, I think the one thing that we didn't do, I mean, we bootstrapped the business and it went from 1 million to 4 million to 9 million to 16 million in revenue. Like at first seemed like it would be this dumb little side hustle that would never amount to anything and just sort of work.
You're listening to the Next Generation Podcast, weekly interviews with the most interesting and successful 20-somethings out there.
Hey, this is Xavier Helgeson. I run a postmodern conglomerate called Endurant Ventures, does almost 100 million in revenue, and welcome to the Next Generation Podcast.
Xavier, I am so excited to have you on today's show, man. Literally just sent a text message to Gio maybe like 45 minutes ago saying, I think I'm kind of fangirling about this episode because you're basically doing everything that I want to be doing in like 10 years. And so I'm excited to spend the next, you know, hour or so just really diving through like how you got started and everything and how you think about starting new projects and whatnot. So thank you so much for coming on today, man.
Yeah, no, really excited as a representative of Gen X on your podcast. Really excited to be here.
Diving right into things. One of the things that I always get really interested in when interviewing people who don't just run one company, but have run several companies and several companies at large scale in the past is like, you've come from a background of like Endava Systems, which is an e-commerce platform and migration plans, you know, Zola Electric, creating energy companies over in Africa, powering over a million users, Better World Books, 70, basically did 70 million and it was a book marketplace. And so you've got like this incredible experience across all different backgrounds now to the point where like you're now running a postmodern conglomerate business that does everything from like pool developers to legal services, right? So like it's all over the place and I love that. I'd love to kind of get an understanding of like how you think about that when you're entering a new industry, right? Like I notice every time that I'll go into a new industry or try something new, it's almost like you're walking in like a dark room and just trying to find the light switch just to like, you know, figure out where you actually are. How do you kind of think about that when you're tackling some of these big problems?
I pepper knowledgeable people with questions. And so the first thing when I'll go into an industry, because if you read, if you Google everything about, let's say the plumbing industry, I'm just gonna use that as an example, you won't get anywhere, really. You won't really understand the business. You need to talk to somebody who's been in plumbing for 20 years. And you just need to keep asking them questions until it just becomes simple. Because at the end, most businesses are actually pretty simple. They provide a service that people pay for. And if they do it well, then the people come back and pay for it. And you know, usually that gets reflected in things like the margin of the business, right? So I've been in very high margin businesses like software and very low margin businesses like selling used books on the internet. And, you know, each one, again, sort of has its own characteristics and its own things you can be good at. And I think the amateur move is, well, I got to get really good at everything. I got to spend 2 years learning to be a software developer and then spend 2 years learning to be a logistics manager and then spend 2 years learning to be a finance director. And the judo is there are people who are amazing at every one of these things. And, you know, if you're going to be an entrepreneur and a generalist, then your job is to basically understand the business well enough to tell whether it's working or it's not working, and then get the right people in the right positions and actually give them autonomy and responsibility to do the thing that they're good at doing.
Finding those people, is it just kind of using your network to figure out, okay, you know, you figured out what industry you want to go in, and now it's just picking up the phone and saying, hey, do you guys know anyone in the pool industry? Do you know anyone there? And then trying to get on the phone with them and just going from there.
And you'll find people love to talk. I am actually in one of these expert network businesses, and I typically donate my time to charity. So I will charge like $750 an hour when someone wants to speak to an expert in the used book industry and then just donate it to charity. And because I love that industry, right? And I know so much about used books, I've gotten more than most people will ever know about used books. And so I don't currently own a used book business, and I will again at some point. I'm hunting, but I just love to talk about it. And so I think that the truth is that if you find people who have either started businesses in these sectors, and you buy them a nice cup of coffee, and you're genuinely curious, like, you can learn so much, especially when someone's had 20, 30, 40 years experience. And it's one thing, like, I advise, like, my millennial brethren a lot, is like, it's easy to underestimate the value of experience, and it's easy to underestimate how much experience people actually want to share with people on their way up, because you have as much to give as somebody coming up. You have a tremendous amount to give, which is, you have energy, you understand technology in a very modern way. You have lots of friends who have lots of energy. And so you can get a crew together of people who will crank for 100 hours a week, if that's what it takes, on a new idea or a new vision. I get my buddies together and they're like, the kids have spring break this week, so we can get together for 1 week and, go skiing. And that's like all I can get them together for anymore, because they've all got their life going.
Are you taking a similar framework when you actually look at the high level industry as a whole? Or is that more just, hey, this piqued my interest, now I'm going to chat with people? Or are you taking any sort of, like, I don't know, sophisticated route of, this industry is growing by, this much per year, and, putting something together like that?
I follow my curiosity. And so I think that tends to be, whenever I'm out, I'm out at the hardware store, I'm like, that's kind of cool. That random device that this company's selling, I wonder who invented that, and you kind of go down various rabbit holes. You call the plumber and you're like, cannot get these guys to call me back. And they write the invoice on a piece of paper. Like, what is up with this industry? And then you kind of get down a rabbit hole. And so I think that the rabbit holes have often served me really well. The main project that we're, the new main new project we're working on in Durian Venture, and is I'm most excited about, came to me because I put my Calendly on Twitter and said, if anybody wants to talk to me for 15 minutes, here's my calendar. And I did 120 calls.
This is after the whole, like, one person got upset about, like, the power move of sending a Calendly.
It was in direct response to that. And so I went viral by saying, my quote, and you can bleep this, is, fuck it, here's my Calendly. And that tweet was seen by hundreds of thousands of people. And so I eventually had to shut it off after like 120 people booked. But one of those calls we will almost certainly go into business with. And I'm incredibly excited about what they are building. And I would have never in a million years gone down that rabbit hole without that coming to me.
That's so cool. You mentioned, like, 5 minutes ago, you said one quote I really liked, and the amateur move is to get good at everything. And I look at somebody in your spot right now, and I see, like, clearly the things that you seem to be quite good at is, like, recognizing technology at an early stage, being able to, like, really allocate capital effectively and, like, hire and manage great teams to run that, right? The big thing that I sometimes struggle with, especially, like, being early in their career, is, like people who are listening to this podcast probably don't have access to much capital. They probably don't really know if they can necessarily hire and manage a team right off the bat. So I'd love to maybe know, like, if the goal is to end up where you are, or trying to go and, like, be an entrepreneur and run one or multiple businesses, and you're 22 or 23 today, is there a specific maybe skill set that you think would be really good to try to go and hone in at an early age? That way you can kind of transfer that over into some of those later skills later on.
That is an astute question. So so the one exception to what I just said is that it is extremely helpful to actually know how to build something. And so one of the best things that ever happened in my career was when I was 18 or 19, my one of my college buddies, his brother-in-law had a web design company, and they were, they're building dynamic websites, right? So sort of things you would build with Ruby or PHP at that time. At point, we used a language called ColdFusion. I was a nerdy guy. Like, I knew a little bit about programming, and actually a lot about computers, but, like, I didn't know how to build that sort of thing. And so being an intern there, I mean, I've made, like, whatever, 10 bucks an hour, but I got this incredibly valuable skill set where now I can build dynamic websites. And so if I have any idea for a good website and the late 90s, I can build it. And so, I built what at the time was the biggest teacher review platform, as in college, just myself. And, like, the coding was utter crap when I look back on it. I still remember how stupid I was about like the architecture, but like I could build it. I could just sit down, put my head down and build something useful that people would use. And then when I got feedback, I could make it better. And I think that people lose contact with that a little bit. And they, you know, as all these people who are like product managers and stuff now, but they don't actually know how to do anything. And so that would be my one exception is like, learn to build hardware, learn to build software, or learn to do design. Like those are three really useful things that you can, if I'm a really good designer, I can probably hire someone to implement it. If I'm a really good coder, I can probably hire a designer to make it pretty. If I'm a really good hardware engineer, like I will just naturally get sucked into all sorts of interesting rabbit holes and projects. And that will be, you know, something interesting will probably come from that. So I think a lot about that. And like, I encourage my kids to learn technical skills and I try to find them mentors and programs where they can do that while still having fun and having sort of fun building things. I would say the other giant cheat code is find a really good mentor in a field that at least you think you might want to be into and be especially persistent about, and this is going to bite me in the ass because a bunch of people are going to do this to me, and that is not the point. The point is be especially persistent with the number of people who you see are succeeding in a field that you think is interesting. And first of all, become their friend. Secondly, try to do something useful for them. If they ask you to do something free, do it free at a high standard. That's probably when I get, you know, when I get cold inbound from people, probably 1 in 100 both follows up diligently and won't let me just ignore it. And number two, when I ask them to do something free for me to prove whether they're really good at or not, they'll do it at exceptional quality. And then next thing you know, we're working on a project together. And that's, you know, I think that's the sort of filtering process that I would encourage everybody to go through is really pick your target and don't, you know, don't give up, make yourself a little annoying in terms of like getting on their radar. And don't take it personally if they're just busy because they might not have any capacity to mentor. But don't give up either and come back to them in 3 months or 6 months and, you know, just kind of stay after it.
On maybe kind of the inverse side of that, you mentioned, you know, it's something that people shouldn't do is try to become, you know, really good at everything necessarily. Is there anything else that you pick out as you see a lot of people in their 20s or somewhere in that age bracket, you know, just kind of wasting a lot of their time where they think they're moving forward, but, you know, it's not actually progressing in kind of really any direction effectively?
Yeah, there's a few of them. So one is people who get management responsibility, but don't realize that management is a technical craft just as difficult as writing software code. And so they think, okay, well, I'll be a good manager. I'll just be nice to everyone. And like, that is the worst possible manager. So the best possible manager, I always encourage people to use the metaphor of a head coach of a professional sports team. And that is your job, right? Your job is to be Steve Kerr and get your 5 players on the field that are going to win you a championship. And your job is then to get as many obstacles out of the way for them as possible. But it starts with those 5. It starts with setting an unreasonably high bar of performance. And unfortunately, it also includes cutting/firing any member of the team that is not willing to perform at that level, because you almost certainly won't get it right. I still get hiring wrong all the time. It's very, very hard to do. There's lots of biases that seep into our hiring processes that we are unaware of, even if we think we're aware of them. And so I wrote a tweet that went viral about learning to fire and how to fire people with grace and dignity. And I think it's something that I see a lot of people really struggle with. So I would say becoming a great manager is on a par with being a great coder or a great financial wizard or anything else, because you can do almost anything if you're a great manager. You can start a plumbing company, know nothing about plumbing, and you will probably be wildly successful, you know, because you know how to actually manage a team, expect a very high level of performance, reward people for that performance. So I would say that's something is, you know, if you're in your 20s, you get your first management responsibility, take that so seriously, read a bunch of books on the topic. It's a book called High Output Management. It's probably 25 years old, still the Bible in this regard, in my view.
Is that the Peter Drucker one or is that a different one?
High Output is Andy Grove, former CEO of Intel. I would say probably a great technical mind who took management as seriously as any technical craft and really laid out like the playbook. It's incredibly easy to read, incredibly hard to actually follow. But if you follow it, you're in probably top 1-2 percentile of managers. So that's one. I also, you know, remember that like your capital, right, when you're young is your time. And so you should really be thinking about how do I spend that time working with the best possible people that I will learn the most from and putting myself in the, if anything, the situation that will stretch my comfort zone the most and will help me grow the most. So I was, when I started Better World Books, I was a complete idiot about most things. Honestly, I thought I knew way more than I actually knew. And, you know, I think the one thing that we didn't do, I mean, we bootstrapped the business and it went from 1 million to 4 million to 9 million to 16 million in revenue, like year after. So we just hit this thing that at first seemed like it would be this dumb little side hustle that would never amount to anything and just sort of worked. And I think the one thing we did right is we just put our head down and we worked as hard as we could. And the one thing we did wrong is honestly, we didn't find more mentors early on who had been through everything. Because we were like, oh no, we're using software and e-commerce. This is so new. And like the best advice we got was from really old school business guys who like didn't know how to work their cell phone. And you know, I think that is as true today.
Yeah, I feel like I'll be the first to admit that I definitely fell up in the trap the last like year or two of not giving experience as much credit as it probably should have. And the biggest tip that I've kind of taken away from hiring, from just chatting with a few people who have hired hundreds of people more than I ever have, is just hire somebody who has done exactly what you're looking for before. It'll save you so much time and headache, and it'll answer like all of the questions that you didn't even know that you were supposed to have. So that definitely resonates true a lot with me. I know you just gave a lot of good advice for people like in their 20s, everything in between like management and also like trying to focus on more tangible skills of like how can you build and how can you design things. Is there advice that you hear floated around to people early in their career very often that you just totally disagree with? And that can be anything from, I guess, career to like lifestyle approach and how people are going and kind of tackling things.
Yeah, there's, you know, there's a lot of conflicting advice. There's probably two schools of thought. One is like, you should work your ass off in your 20s and you should work every living hour. And the other one is like, you should just take time and explore and like discover the world. And I sort of found that doing both worked really well for me. So when I was 23, I took 3.5 months and just lived on a bicycle in Europe I didn't work. I just biked around and kind of traveled and saw a bunch of Europe.
Were you camping or going to the hostels or like when you say you lived?
Yeah. So I probably camped probably 2/3 of the time and went to the hostel 1/3 of the time. So I had like, it was like self-contained bike touring, which I found very enjoyable personally as a way to travel. And it was also a very cheap way to travel. And I, you know, I traveled a lot through my 20s, like a lot. Like I probably traveled 6 or 8 weeks a year. And then I just worked I worked very, very hard when I worked. We were in the textbook business early in Better World Books. And so we would probably do half of our sales in 4 weeks of the year, you know, 2 weeks when people come back in the fall and in the winter. And we would literally sleep under shipping tables. So we would have beds set up and we would, you know, get maybe 4 or 5 hours of sleep, wake up and just start shipping more books because we were shipping, you know, 10,000 plus orders a day with a relatively small team. And there was just no room for, you know, not getting them out. And so I don't know. I think that people try to have this dogma that, you know, this one size fits all dogma. And honestly, I think for some people, like it's the traveling that will give them a unique idea or insight or, and maybe just they might meet someone who does what they might like to do. And I think it's also totally okay for someone to say, you know, I just want to surf. I don't want to be I don't need to be a millionaire. I just need to, you know, get by in life. Like, I think there's a lot of paths to happiness and it's more sort of having exposure to enough people that you can zoom into what is your particular flavor of fulfillment look like.
Yeah. I think that's well said. I think, I wrote something the other day that basically said, like, when it comes to advice, the tough part and like the paradox of the internet really is the fact that like you can have two people with completely contradicting beliefs, right? Like one person says, if you want to be a millionaire, you have to buy Bitcoin. The other person says, if you want to be a millionaire, you got to buy gold and index funds, right? And the fact is they can both be right. The thing that I think a lot of young people need to kind of go and start researching a little bit more is like, what are the truths behind both of those? And the truths realistically are like, okay, can I go and own equity in some kind of appreciating asset, right? And then like apply that principle to other areas in life too. But I completely agree. I mean, you don't know myself or Gio that well at all. But like the past 2 years have just been Airbnb hopping pretty much. So like in New York for the month, going to Costa Rica next month, Portugal the following month. So like I completely subscribe to the idea that like I find hustle culture is often predicated around this idea that like some level of insecurity, like if I don't work this hard, I'm not going to get to where I am. The truth mm-hmm. is like, that's oftentimes, I think, just a myth that was propagated by, you know, just a bunch of people sharing all that stuff on social media, you get in an echo chamber. And in reality, like, I don't know, I feel like you read enough blog posts and books at some point where you realize like, everyone's going to die, like go on that surf trip, go on that bike trip across Europe. Like, I mean, and even from your standpoint, if I read correctly, your story, you've learned about like the need for solar panels and creating energy when traveling. And then it wasn't until you got to Oxford that you actually like went deep and really studied that entire subject, right?
Yeah, it was hitchhiking in Malawi, and it's funny, it's a good story actually. So I was with Better World Books, we donated a lot of books to Africa, and so there were a number of trips we took to go see, you know, recipients of the books. And this one trip I took was with all these nice older folks from Minnesota who were donors to this organization that was based in Minnesota. Lovely people. But after like a week and a half, I was like, okay, I need a little more adventure than what this crew is doing. And so I asked them to leave me by the side of the road in Malawi. And it took like an hour to convince them, like, no, guys, I'm really going to be fine. I promise I'll be fine. Just leave me here.
Just up here on the corner is good. Yeah, that'll work.
Yeah, up here on the corner is good. And then I hitchhiked, and I will never forget after they left, it was like 30 minutes till the first vehicle came by. I was like, oh, I really underestimate how many vehicles come down this road. And fortunately, this first vehicle stopped, and you know, got in the back and ended up at this very, very cool, it's a little bit of a backpacker mecca on Lake Malawi.
Where is Malawi?
Malawi's in the middle, essentially the middle of Africa, kind of the south middle of Africa. It's a landlocked country, very, very beautiful, very friendly country. Actually, probably never been anywhere I felt like safer, to be honest. The first day I was there, I went scuba diving, and the scuba instructor invited me. I was traveling with a friend as well, invited us to his home. And that was the first time I'd really been in like an off-grid community. And he just came with a kerosene lamp, and we went down all these completely dark alleys. You know, this is like a 10,000 person community. It's not a small town. And I was just like, wow, if I disappear here, like I will never be, like no one will know where I am. Like I will never be found. And we ate dinner by kerosene lantern. And that was sort of my exposure to like, wow, this is just how people are living. Like this guy totally has income. He just has no electricity, like, you know, and it really stuck with me.
I'm curious kind of on the timeline of a lot of these ventures you've done. So you started with Better World Books. Was it right after Better World Books where you, because I believe you decided to move full time to Tanzania. It yep. was to go work on Zola Electric. So was that a linear transition there, or what did that feel like in terms of, it seems kind of like a drastic
jump. It's a drastic jump. And, you know, the way that played out was I left full time in Better World Books after about 7 years, and I got a scholarship to go to Oxford University. So Oxford has a scholarship for social entrepreneurs to get their MBA. And so, you know, it's an unbelievable deal if you can get it, because it my MBA was paid for. They even gave me a stipend, and it got me in this very interesting community of other social entrepreneurs. So it was the perfect place to sort of go and think about like, what are the big problems in the world, and like, which one could I work on, and which one am I getting fired up on? And I just got very into this notion that distributed energy was going to take off in Africa. and it was going to be a big, big deal. And I thought, you know, the deeper I got into it, the more convinced I was that that was true. And that was maybe in 2010, 2011. And I cared a lot about climate change. And so I thought, okay, well, you know, I really want to start a company in this. And it was actually my co-founder who had worked in Africa for a decade. And she was like, look, you want to do this, you got to move. You can't just start this company from California. You got to move. That's kind of like, oh, I guess I got to move. So that was what, you know, picked up and moved to Tanzania with a young family in, you know, in 2012, and just got to work. I mean, had a little investment from some friends from the e-commerce world. And, you know, we started with no technology, no customers, no nothing, and just got to work on this problem of how do we make solar affordable and accessible to the mass market here.
You are now powering over 1 million individuals over in Africa, if my stats are correct.
Yep.
Here. So it's got to be this incredibly great feeling to see like something that you created from nothing now helping so many lives. I want to kind of like jump back to when you first moved over there, because when I was in college, I did a bunch of like social entrepreneurship classes and programs. And like one of them, we went over to South Africa for a little bit, and we were doing a bunch of work regarding like giving eyeglasses to people, and like kind of like working with this one school called like SIPA, and like really, really cool stuff, and like kind of getting to know them. And I just remember being over there for maybe 3 or 4 weeks. And like, I felt like we were doing good work, but also just felt like the most immense guilt I think I've ever felt in my entire life, of like going over and being like, cool. So like we work for like 8-10 hours a day. And then I go and I can go and eat at any restaurant in the city that I pretty much want to. And then we go back and go all over again. Meanwhile, like these kids at these schools that I'm at, like are taking 2.5 hour train rides every single day, and like going home to like way not as nice, you know, townships and things like that from where I was staying. When you first got over there and you were like, I'm here, I'm ready to work, was it ever like emotionally difficult, or are you always kind of looking at it from like that business standpoint of like, I think we can make a lot of really powerful impact?
Yeah, you know, it was, I would say it's wide emotional swings, right? So it's both like really hard sometimes because you see how people are living and struggling, but it's also, you know, the slums of Africa are one of the most optimistic places I've ever been, because you talk to the average person living in a slum in Nairobi, and they will be way more optimistic about the future than the average American you'll stop on the street, which is bonkers, right? Because the average American probably makes about 100 times the income of the average, you know, the average African in the slums. And it's all, what you learn is it's all relative, right? So the folks living in the Nairobi slum will evaluate their life compared to everyone else they know in the Nairobi slum. And, you know, I came from a lower middle class family in rural Minnesota. And so I always had a little bit of chip on my shoulder. And, you know, I look back on that and I think, well, that struggle was also what made me tough. And so we have this, you know, we have this notion, right, that we want everybody's life to be comfortable and easy, but it's entirely unclear that that's, certainly our ancestors did not have a comfortable, easy life. And the vast majority of our ancestors did not have indoor plumbing, did not have electricity, did not have indoor heating. And at least mine date back to, you know, Norway in the 1300s, could not have been an amazing place to live. Somehow they did it, right? they just buried fish in the ground and dug it out in the middle of winter. And so I sort of think about that and I say that's the real tension of our modern times, right? Is to both stay tough, but also stay optimistic. And so then when I look at that, I think, well, if I'm doing something that sort of makes life fundamentally better for a lot of people here, like in some ways I can way more leverage in terms of like fundamentally improving people's lives here than I probably could of anything I could do that would be useful in the US.
How quickly after you moved there did you realize that this was actually a viable and scalable business? Did you go with the intent of, hey, I want to make this massive company and you know, bring power to everyone? Or was it, let's just see if we can make a product, we get it sold and see what happens from there?
No, it was a pretty ambitious vision. Like I definitely wasn't going to build like a profitable business. I know that sounds dumb, but like if I want to start a profitable company, like I had really obvious opportunities back in the US, like in the used book industry, or like I honestly could have just gone back and been CEO of Better World Books. And that would have been like almost certainly a way that I would have made more money and with less risk. And so, it really was like, hey, the worst possible thing that's going to happen is this business will fail. I'll come back to the US. I'll call my buddies in the tech industry and somehow I'll get a job. And that, you know, the best possible case scenario is that we will actually make something work here because we're going to go take a risk most other people won't take. And we will sort of bridge, hopefully, the Western world of technology and capital with the need in this market. So, you know, one of the things that really put us on the map in the early days was SolarCity, which is now a part of Tesla, making a significant investment in the company. And so that really woke the whole, honestly, the whole Western world up to the idea that solar in Africa wasn't just a charity project, but it was actually something that, you know, could be an exciting business. And there were probably four or five other companies that were sort of peers that raised a lot of capital, you know, after that, as it kind of got put on the map. So we were pretty ambitious from the early days. Doesn't mean we didn't almost fail a bunch of times. You know, we started with a slightly different business model that once we got there, it kind of turned out it didn't work very well. And so I remember, you know, our initial thesis of how we were going to do it was sort of destroyed about 4 months in. I remember just sitting in my office thinking, oh God, this is not going to work. I'm going to look like an idiot for having moved to Africa. And it's going to go home with our tail between our legs. And then it was funny, like the next day I woke up, it's like, oh, well, here's something that might work. And, you know, we just started on pursuing a fundamentally different way of in some ways, a much simpler way. What we did is we found an off-the-shelf solar system that we essentially could just buy and put a sticker on and charge for mobile money for its usage. And so we didn't have any of the fancy hardware or the IoT integration. We had a solar power system with a sticker on it that did about what we expected that the product we would build in the future would do. And we set a price that we thought was a price that people would actually pay. And then we just started learning. And it was like the most rapid learning you could possibly imagine. Once, you know, we actually got in the market and customers asked us a bunch of questions and we got systems in the home and we saw if they would pay or not. And very, very quickly, that was what we were able to raise money on to actually build the thing that would do this at scale.
And the big difference is, right, you're spending the upfront money to buy the equipment and then you're not really financing it, but you're charging either not by the day or by the week or however. So you're kind of providing some sort of back-end financing options that really just weren't available.
That's really the thing, because what unlocked that market was the nexus of technology and finance, you know, because essentially a customer couldn't make a giant capital expenditure for a solar battery system in their home. At least that a lot of them couldn't. And even if they could, they didn't know sort of who to trust. They didn't know if they bought something that it would keep working. And so by aligning the payment cycle, so I pay and the lights come on and that all works. So then I make my next payment and the lights stay on. And we originally did it like a pure utility model. And then for a variety of reasons, we went to a model where they own it after a period of time. So it ended up being a sort of 3-year lease to own as we went out and we learned.
Was that one of the first examples of, because that's from my understanding how most solar in the US works, where they're, you know, it's pretty much a big financing play where they'll come, put all the solar in and then charge you every month, you know, the financing fee rather than paying the utility. Kind of sounds like, did you reinvent that model first in Africa with these devices?
I would say we sort of co-pioneered it. Let's put it that way. So we took many learnings from that business. So the CEO of SolarCity, Lyndon Reeve, one of the best entrepreneurs I've ever met in my life. He was our chairman, and he very much brought in the knowledge, every bit of knowledge. I mean, he would put his structured finance guys for SolarCity and say, "Go work on Zola for the next week. Help them figure out how to finance their solar systems." And so he really brought in a lot of knowledge of how things worked in the West. But then, you know, it's a little different. So for us, like integrating with mobile money was critical. We used the prepaid model. So if you don't pay, it doesn't work, which people are used to from prepaid mobile phones. So we had to adapt it to the context.
That's really interesting. I have a question here now that, like, it'll probably bring us a little bit more towards Endeavor Ventures and like kind of the stuff you're doing there. But I guess I want to frame it where I hear all this business background that you're doing over like with around like education, with like used books and like getting those to the masses, and also like adding like power and electricity to a lot of rural Africa, right? Like these seem like life-changing, really like philanthropic businesses that actually became very profitable businesses too. Like I don't mean for this question to come off in the wrong way. And so I want to phrase it simply, but like you're going from what feels like a lot of these triple bottom line businesses of like, we care about people, planet and profits and all of that to now shifting into more like you're doing pool development, right? And like certainly like people need pools, but it's not like changing the world, empowering Africa kind of businesses. And so I guess the way I want to phrase this question is like, was there a transition point when you're like, hey, I just want to go and build really profitable businesses and scale up and run this postmodern conglomerate?
Yeah, it's a really astute question. And it was something I struggled with a bit as I did it, right? Because what I realized about myself is that I'm an entrepreneur and business person first. Like I'm not, as much as I love that I started a business that, gets textbooks to Africa or provides, light in people's homes in Africa. Like I find those interesting because they're interesting businesses. And I find that the social impact side is motivating like for a day or like a week, but like it's really hard to wake up every morning, go to a supply chain meeting and then like, go to a budget meeting and think, oh, you keep that motivation that, no, I'm doing all this because people are going to get light, maybe some people can do that. I found that sort of burned me out. And I actually saw a lot of social entrepreneurs burn out, where they didn't get the economic side of their life stable enough. And they were sort of economic martyrs for a long period of time. I was not quite as much of that because at least I was always on the commercial side, but I've certainly seen this with nonprofit social entrepreneurs who built huge organizations and still live on extremely, extremely modest incomes, which is honestly, it's fine when you're single, but as you get kids, you get a bit older, like there, you definitely have I have found a higher baseline cost of living that I need to cover to live the life I want to live. What I did is really sort of imbue Enduring Ventures with purpose. So for us, we both have a more sustainable and inclusive vision of capitalism. We find it very, very motivating to steward businesses in a way that is not short-term minded. There's a lot of short-term operators out there who are trying to buy businesses and flip them. And that usually comes at the cost of both the employees and the customers of the business. One way to maximize profits is to fire a bunch of people who are working on anything that is in the future. And so as long-term stewards, we're trying to set an example here that, hey, there's another way to invest. And it's actually a really old school way that's sort of been forgotten. In the craze of private equity and venture capital, but it's a much more sober, sustainable way to invest. And the other thing is, we actually start really high impact companies. So we've founded two companies with the resources from that pool construction company is basically funded two climate tech startups. That now have taken on external investors. And one is essentially sort of piped for climate tech. So basically doing revenue-based financing for climate-focused companies. And the other one is trying to revolutionize the way people cook in Africa, making that carbon negative. And that's something that, that's actually a business model I was passionate about with Zola, but never got to do because we were so singularly focused as a company. And also I was CEO of Zola, so I can really do anything else. But having this opportunity to start something that I believe in and having the resources to do it, it's been really surprising, actually, how mission-focused and mission-aligned this has been.
I'm assuming you probably also have shiny object syndrome, and Connor mentioned it before, like we're always doing a million different projects. And I think that's probably personally also one of the most difficult things I struggle with is, okay, I have a new company that I want to start every week, right? And I want to drop everything and just do that. And I feel like a lot of people in your position, you have a whole host of, vastly different companies that from the surface don't really seem to be intertwined in any real, I can't see a lot of, combinations between pool building and, retail audits, for example. Is there a specific thesis on why you have, you know, some of these non-tangential businesses? Is it because it's really interesting, or is it A, just a really good business and you want to invest in it? Or what is your thought process between, you know, keeping things aligned in the same direction versus just buying the business because it's good or interesting, or you know, you like the founder or something?
Yeah, so I think what the way I'll answer that is actually we have a focused investment thesis that is around both the returns and the people we want to work with. And so above all else, we want to work with kind people that we really respect as CEOs. And all of our CEOs are entrepreneurial. They have to be. And so what we try to do is really vest them with as much autonomy as possible and as much support as possible, and let them go sort of where they want to go, to be honest. If they're the quality person we think they are, then we just want to be a part of whatever they're building. And so the way we run the company is that we take on no day-to-day operational responsibilities whatsoever. We are board members to our CEOs, and we are sometimes investors in their companies. Sometimes we'll buy a new company for them, but that is usually led by them. And sometimes we'll find a new CEO. We are really, really excited about that because we find a new CEO who knows something about a sector that we think is interesting. Then we get very excited to back them to either buy a business or start a business or grow a business. And so it really starts with the people, and it starts with an unusually high expectation of return. So there's one Buffett quote. Again, most of this is a naked ripoff of Warren Buffett. I cannot say that loudly enough. And it is just stealing his good idea and adapting it to the present moment. So one thing he said, which I thought was fascinating, was he said, look, if you give me $1 million today, I can make 50% a year. I guarantee it. He's like, I can't do that on $10 billion. There's just not, there's not enough good opportunities when you're big. So when you're big, you have to fundamentally change what you do. And you go and buy railroads and stuff like that, where you can put, you know, a large amount of money to work. And, you know, he's almost never cocky. And so that one really struck me, because he was like, no, I know I could make 50% a year. And so our thesis is similar, where we're not professional money managers. We don't have a private equity fund. That's not how we're set up. Enduring Ventures Inc. is a C corporation that is set up to have shareholders who are mainly our friends and family, to grow, you know, to really steward their capital and to grow some wealth for them. And you know, again, for myself, I will give away most of my money, and so I want you know, my shares to end up in the hands of impact organizations that I think, if I do my job and I grow the value of those shares, that gives them resources to you know, to deliver more impact themselves. So all that to say, our investment hurdle is 100% return per year. And so I need to do a deal that will return all my capital in year one, and then all of it again, and still own the business.
Does that work? Like, has that been sustainable?
We've done it 14 times.
Okay.
Wow.
And so, you know, the initial capital base was $2 million of equity. And so was not a lot of equity. Current equity value of the company is north of $100 million. So it's, for example, we bought a company called UpCouncil, which you may have seen because we've been more public about that. So I'll talk about that one. We bought its previous last valuation was $50 million when it raised its Series B. We bought the entire business for $200,000 in equity.
The valuation is after you guys bought the business.
So the $50 million valuation was the last time they raised venture capital money.
You bought them after they raised venture capital.
Yeah, I bought them about a year and a half after that for $200,000.
Gotcha, okay. Wow.
And I was the buyer of last resort, because they had they had burned through the venture capital. They hadn't grown as fast as they wanted. They found a company that would acquire the engineering team and the founders. So basically the founders and the engineering team got a soft landing. But that company, which was LinkedIn, didn't want the actual product. They didn't want the bother of running UpCouncil, the legal services platform, which is an I've been a customer for 8 years. I loved it. It's how I've incorporated most of my companies. It's how what my go-to if I need a lawyer. I got a patent review done one time for like $400 just recently. Like I still am a big user of it. And so, you know, because I hate paying lawyers thousands of dollars just to be on phone calls. And what's genius about the platform is it's independent lawyers on one side who've left the big firms, and it's most of the deals are fixed price or low introductory hourly price. So it's like a good idea, but it's a better small business than a big business, if that makes sense. And so we bought it with no employees. It's the only time I've broken my rule and been CEO of it. I was CEO for a month until we found the woman who runs it. And we turned it around. It was profitable within 30 days. We got it to a point where it could raise money from its customers. So we did a Reg CF crowdfund, and we raised $4 million at a $28 million valuation at the end of last year. So we essentially sold off about 15% of the company for $4 million. So that's the sort of thing that would hit our return threshold.
That's incredible. Yeah, I mean, so when I hear stories like this, and I hear 100% returns every year, and you've done it 14 times now at this point, like, is your, I guess, the long-term mission of Enduring, like, is your goal then to theoretically just keep on returning capital and always try to stay, like, small is so relative here because you guys are doing 100 million revenue, like that is gargantuan in my mind. But like when you compare it to Berkshire, right, it's small. So is your goal and mission to always try to keep it like under that sub 1 billion mark?
Well, it's actually to grow the family above that. So I want to see the family of businesses grow as big as it can get. But I want to federate it. And so that's probably the one difference from our model to Berkshire's that at least I believe in, is what I want to do is find CEOs who want to set up their own baby Berkshire in their area of expertise. So we have one baby Berkshire that does nothing but these venture capital turnarounds. We have now bought three companies in that and are just in talks to potentially buy a fourth. So that's all they do. They parachute in. They're the management team when they turn it around, and then they get get someone hired in to be long-term CEO of the business and get a strategy in place and a board in place. We have another platform company that does HVAC and plumbing. And again, we teach them our operating methodology too. So it's about delegation to the point of abdication. So you know, for example, there is a company called Anderson Air in Northwest Arkansas. That is actually run by its family business. We bought it because the senior members of the family were retiring, but the junior members of the family still worked in the business and still loved the business. And so we have essentially partnered with them to keep running it. And they run, if you go into Anderson Air, you would have no idea that, you know, it's owned by Snowball Industries, which is owned by Enduring Ventures partially. It just runs like a great local HVAC company, and John Anderson runs the business. And the better the business does, the more money he makes. And so that's sort of the goal here, right? Is to ultimately federate it down to a bunch of beautiful small and mid-sized businesses that run independently and have dedicated leadership.
Are there some platform rollups that are significantly easier than others, or maybe have better growth? I guess if Connor and I sat down and we're like, hey, we want to kind of copy this model, but start with, platform A, you can either do, pool development or HVAC or SaaS turnarounds. Are there any of these that you've seen that, are relatively good stepping stones to get some sort of exposure to this sort of industry?
I would say that there's simpler and more complex businesses out there, right? So like, you could probably get your head around like power washing in like a week, and truth be told, with some hustle and some internet marketing, you could probably start a power washing business that pretty quickly could have a very nice turnover. So there's a bunch of these things where you don't even need to buy them. You can just see something boring and useful in your community and get a sense of how big the market is. And it, honestly, it can be pretty small because we live in a gigantic economy. and you know, get some conviction. Maybe you find somebody who's an expert in power washing too, and has run a power washing company for a decade, and you say, let's team up together. We're going to go launch a new company, or we're going to buy an existing company with an SBA loan, or going to do something to get rolling. And that's probably the number one thing I would say, is just like, get in the game. It doesn't really matter what you're in, but once you're in the cash flow positive game, and that could really take on a wide variety of forms, you tend to learn and you tend to see a lot of opportunities, and you tend to see adjacent opportunities if you're kind of smart and entrepreneurial. And I certainly think it's the safest game to play in terms of like a risk, financial risk reward.
Buying like, businesses, you mean?
Yeah, buying businesses, or I would say start, I would almost put in that category, starting businesses that don't require much capital. So both of those are very viable approaches. So starting a landscaping company or power washing company, or a, you could start a company that just cleans millennials' apartments, right? And you can make online booking, so they never have to talk to anyone. They just do it from their phone. Online invoicing, just auto charges their card via Apple Pay, and you'd be ahead of 99% of other cleaning companies. And you could probably charge a premium for that, and therefore probably easily hire good cleaners who will reliably do the work because you would pay them a premium. Like, and it would be so stupid simple to do. And I've actually seen people do this and crush it. Like that exact business model I've seen people do and crush, and can be done in any market in the whole country.
Yeah. It's literally Geo's dream.
Yeah. And so I think, like, you know, when I say low risk, I mean, like, compared to like a venture-backed startup is really hard and it takes a really long time. And it might, even if it's successful, you still might not make any money. Like, I have, you know, Zola has taken, at this point, over $200 million in capital in. And so if someone comes along and buys that business for $199 million tomorrow, you know, I don't see a dollar of that, right? Yeah. And so, you know, hopefully it will eventually exit for much more than that, but it's a very risky business, takes a very long time. You know, all of our cash flow positive businesses, like, we own them outright, the majority of them, or we have trusted partners that we're in partnership with, 50-50 or whatever. And, you know, I could probably do absolutely nothing. I could just like go to the beach from this point on. And in all likelihood, you know, all these companies would take care of my needs and, you know, more than I would ever need in my life. Like, you know, I will do much more than that, but like that, the initial positive momentum and incentives are already in place. Yeah. And those could decay over time, but in general, if you have good people responsible for things and they get a share of the upside, then they tend to keep, you know, things going in the right direction.
Right. The incentives are aligned. I love that. Xavier, I feel like, you know, before we even pressed record on this, you know, you kind of gave us the background, like, on, like, you know, you've been media trained, and like, I've watched plenty of your YouTube videos now just to kind of prep for this call at this point. And so I'm sure most podcasts you do, you're chatting about Zola, you're chatting about Better World Books, you're chatting about like how you're thinking about setting up this conglomerate. This might sound like almost somewhat of like a meta question, I guess, but like, is there like a question that you wish that I kind of asked you today, or like throughout this podcast, that you personally really enjoy, or like find that it's like pretty influential to like who you are as a person, but you just don't like talk about a lot publicly?
That's an awesome question. So I'll give you two. So I would say one is, what is your mission? And the other is, what is your essence? And I ask, what is your essence a lot as a interview question. And so I always find it, at first stumps someone and they look at me a little funny, and then they engage in intense self-reflection for somewhere between 5 seconds to a minute. And then they usually give me a really interesting answer. And so I've actually never been asked this question. So I need to reflect on it for a second, because I just shot it from the hip to myself. But I would, what I would say is that my essence is to see around corners. And that's what I spend, that's what I will bring to an organization that most people will not bring, but is usually really valuable, is seeing the whole possibility set of both what could happen if things go right, and what could happen if things go wrong, and then trying to bring those back to the present and both mitigate the downside risks and maximize the upside potential. So that's that. My mission, I got really clear on this relatively recently, which is my personal mission is to rewild as much of the globe as possible. And so my accumulation of capital will flow to that in the end in one way or another. And I think it's both
rewild as in like nature conservation kind of stuff.
Yeah. Hardcore, like take barren land and turn it into thriving forest kind of stuff.
And
utilize modern technology and utilize modern business models. So it's not just a pure, it's something that to the extent possible can actually self-fund and grow. And so that's really the rabbit hole I've been down because I think that people underestimate the potential we have to turn barren land and deserts into thriving forest and beautiful ecosystems. And we've had sort of the past 100 years, we've had this economic system that's just kind of destroyed, frankly, a lot of beautiful wild places. And we absolutely can use that same system to reverse it. We just need creativity and willpower.
That's incredibly cool. Xavier, I want to be really respectful of your time here. Gio and I know we did not get to half of the stuff we laid out here, but
this was a tough episode in terms of like, I have so many questions still here that I just haven't crossed off, but like, yeah, this is awesome. I'm happy we got through the questions we got through at least.
It's been fun to jam with you guys. I really appreciate it.
Of course. So for sure people should follow Xavier on Twitter. That's how we got connected here. What's your handle?
It's at Xavier Helgeson, Helgesen. I'm the only person with that name on the internet that I'm aware of, so easy to find.
Perfect. All right, we'll definitely link to that in the show notes. Xavier, the last thing I just want to wrap up here is like, I feel like you dropped so many resources throughout this. Like, aside from every piece of content that you're putting out, are there things that you typically consume pretty often that you think other people would benefit from?
Yeah, read The Economist. If you don't subscribe to that, it's my absolute favorite way to understand what's going on in the world. Book called The Outsiders. I make every one of our CEOs read it. I think it's the most important book on being a CEO or a business person that exists.
That's the one of like 12 different business CEOs or something like that, right?
Yeah, The Outsiders by Thorndike. It's not particularly well marketed, but man, is that an interesting book. Very, very inspiring. I try to reread it every couple of years. Other than that, read Great Fiction. I love books. I think of my profession as a bookseller. I put my job as office librarian on LinkedIn if you ever find me there. I love Neil Gaiman's works. I love Chuck Palahniuk's works. And there's many, many great writers that I will not name here, but you can easily find if you're into books.
Awesome. We're going to make sure we'll link to everything down below. Thank you again for coming on. I think this was an awesome episode. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate it.
If you thought today's episode was awesome, we would love it if you would leave a 5-star review on the podcast, either on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It makes a huge difference and lets us get cooler and cooler guests for future episodes.